And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Griff from San Diego.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Griff, and I'm an alcoholic. First, a good friend of mine, whose name is Big Book Ron, reminds me that no one speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous because we have a book, and the book tells the story. And whenever I'm asked to speak, I always bring another book along with me. It's called Guide to Intelligent Drinking. There's a difference between these books. I can find myself in this book several times. They don't talk about me in this book. If you want to be successful in this book, I'll break it down for you. All you have to do is decide how many drinks you're going to have and then stop at that number. And you're successful. If you have one more, you lose a point. And if you have one less, you gain a point. They don't have drink till you pass out or run out. But this is a real book with a Library of Congress number and everything. So this is the one that I rely on. This is a real book too. It is. This is a real book. Fortunately, I've been in AA long enough, so I've lost all of my character defects. Except for lying. So I have to, I've also been told that what I really need to do is tell the truth, because all of our stories are perfect. All of our stories are perfect because here we are sitting next to each other in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our stories got us here just the way they were. We don't have to add to them or take away from them or try to make them sound like this one or that one. Our stories are perfect, just exactly the way they are. So I'll try to tell the truth and tell you my story. What it was like for me, I grew up, I was born in March of 1944, which makes me 67 years old. And I know I only look 66 and a half, but and in these lights I look a lot smaller than I am too. And it sometimes in this light my hair looks a little gray. But I was born in Connecticut, and I was born in Connecticut in 1944, and I grew up in an Irish family. So there were a lot of drinking. No one ever mentioned the word alcoholic, but people were drinking. I don't remember this, but they tell me my first drink was when I was about 3 years old. There was a party at my grandmother's house, and I went into the icebox and took out a bottle of wine and started drinking the bottle of wine, and then I started singing and dancing and peeing my pants and passed out. Nothing changed for about 30 years. I had a very neutral childhood. When I was a kid, some things happened to me that shouldn't happen to children. And it made me very standoffish and very aloof. And I never really felt a part of anything. I come from a big family, and I never really felt a part of it. I felt like I was just put in there somehow. I had friends, but I had different groups of friends, so I could, so no one would ever really get the true story of what was going on with me. I was very, I was very secretive, and that ran in my family too. My mother's favorite saying was, "Don't let anybody know your business." And that's an old Irish thing too, because when they grew up in Ireland, you didn't know who was your friend or who was your foe or who you could trust or who you couldn't trust. So you didn't want the neighbors knowing your business. And I picked that up pretty well. I started drinking probably in the seventh or eighth grade. I was a good student, but I really didn't try. I was a good student without trying. And I ran around with a bunch of guys who were, you know, young people like myself who didn't try either. So we started, for some reason, we started drinking, and when I was a kid, you could buy 7-Up came in bottles, so we would fill up the bottles with blackberry brandy. For some reason, we could get blackberry brandy, and we would just literally, as little kids, walk around the street drinking. And if, you know, on Halloween, where would we go to liquor stores to steal liquor? It was a common thing for us to be drinking. How old are you? In the seventh and eighth grade, maybe 12 or 13 years old, on a regular basis. And that kept up. I had a course in high school that, I went to a parochial school, through the eighth grade. And you know, I did all right there, but I never really tried. And when I got into high school, I never really tried either. I always thought I was going to wind up in reform school, and my high school curriculum was almost like a reform school curriculum. It was very easy for me, and I was, by this time, I'm drinking on a regular basis. I lived in Connecticut, but if you went to New York, you had to be 18, and I swear you could go to New York, and I could be 15 or 16 years old, and I'd hand them a late-to-class pass with my name on it, and they'd ask me what my name was, and I'd tell them, and they'd say, "Okay, what do you want?" And we had kids who were 16, 17 years old that looked 21, could go buy liquor. And interestingly enough for me, I knew most of the winos in the area on a first name basis. And I could go to the winos and tell them to get what I wanted, and it was no problem. You have to be really careful with winos though, because they're not good with numbers. So you had to buy something for the wino, and you knew what you wanted, so you had to give them exact change. You know, they used to drink Muscatel. What's the price? 39 twice. That's how much Muscatel cost, 78 cents at the time. 78 cents a pint. So my drinking was progressive even at that time, even in high school and I was always on the edge of getting in trouble, you know, getting kicked out of the Boy Scouts, getting thrown out of school, getting, you know, whatever it was. I was just always on the edge of something serious, but nothing that I didn't get caught is what I'm trying to say. I did some things that would have taken me off the streets, but I didn't get caught. And then I never thought I would graduate from high school, but I did. I graduated from high school, and a girl in town got in trouble. So I did the manly thing and joined the Navy, of all things. And I went away to boot camp in the Navy. And I told you, I went to parochial school, and I was doing okay in boot camp, but I found out that if you were Jewish and you went to the Jewish services, they served wine. So whenever they asked for Jewish services, I showed up. And I went with another guy that really was Jewish. That's how I found out about the wine. So I did get through boot camp, and they put me in the Seabees. Seabees is a part of the Navy. A construction battalion is part of the Navy out in California. And once I got into the Navy, there was a lot of drinking involved there. They were pretty smart though, because if you were going to go to the club there on the base and drink, they took away your Liberty card, so you couldn't get off base. So I didn't get in too much trouble there. And then they sent me to what was like heaven for a young man, where just anything goes there. This was in the 60s. Anything goes. And I've never really been a moral person, so I got I got involved in all kinds of stuff in the Philippines. I'll give you an example. I would black market cigarettes. I could buy a carton of cigarettes for $1. And then I could sell that carton of cigarettes for $11. So here I am with $11. If you want to trade it into pesos, was what the monetary unit in the Philippines was, it was 7 to 1. So now I had 77 pesos. If you went to a fancy bar, it cost 1 peso for a beer. If you went to a dive, it cost 60 centavos. And anything else you wanted was 2 or 3 pesos. So I was drinking every night, and also had a side business, which was I was a loan shark at the time too, which was very profitable, I have to say, because it kept me from having to do anything but drink. If I could pay people to do the other jobs I was supposed to do. People who I worked for were borrowing money from me. So it worked out pretty well. And at the time, one of my division officers came up to me and said, I scored very well when I went through boot camp. On the battery test, he scored very well. He said, "You know, you scored well here. We're going to have to try and find something else for you to do." So they decided to give me a battery of tests. And in the Philippines, it's very hot, and I was drinking every night, and I was hungover every morning. And they have Quonset huts, and they were giving me this battery of tests in the Quonset hut. And I was literally passing out while I'm taking these tests. So they sat me in front of an air conditioner so I could finish taking the test. So the end result of that was I did pass the test. And for some reason, I was considered for officer candidate school, and I was considered for flight training in Pensacola, Florida. Now, this is a guy who got out of high school taking, you know, remedial math. It wasn't remedial math, but it was like shop math or something like that. So I never had to do any homework. So uh, They gave me a physical, and the next thing I knew, I was on my way to Pensacola, Florida, to become a cadet, and I went to Pensacola, and I was I'm drinking all the time too here. When you were a cadet, they're very strict. They monitor your time very well. The only time you had was after dinner, say from 5:30 to 6:30, you had an hour to go to the store to get the shaving cream, you know, to get the things you needed. During that hour, I would run to the bowling alley and drink as many beers as I could and run back to be there on time for a mandatory study. And I did that. I did that and wound up getting through Pensacola and going to the next training facility. And at the next training facility, my drinking got a little worse. I was at the bar with a senior officer. I'm a cadet, and I'm at a bar with a senior officer. And he said, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to get kicked out of here. And for some reason, I was able to, that scared me. So I was able to stop drinking until I actually got my commission as an ensign in the United States Navy. Never having been to college, just, you know, the thing that saved me was whenever they tested me, they only tested me on the material that they taught me. So I pay attention, and I could pass the test, and I could do as well or better than a lot of other people, because I'm not stupid. I'm just an alcoholic. You'll hear that a lot. The good news and the bad news about alcoholics. Alcoholics are kind, loving, generous, tender people. That's the good news. The bad news is you only hear that from other alcoholics. So here I am. And I was very intimidated by a lot of these people I was going through training with. I mean, some of these people were academic scholarship to Harvard kind of guys. So I was very intimidated. But I got through that and wound up getting my wings, going through a replacement squadron, and being sent to Vietnam. And if you ever saw the movie Top Gun, that's what I was doing. But for real. I mean, with people shooting at you, with SAM missiles, with flak, with all of that stuff. And I'll tell you, it really gets your attention. It really does get your attention. And you'd be surprised how much drinking goes on during combat on a ship. There may be 5,000 people on a Navy carrier, but there may be only 70 or 80 of them who are getting shot at every day. So you found ways to get liquor on board, and people tended to look the other way. I can't tell you how many times people had to literally help me get into my flight gear because I was either so hungover or so had so much to drink. And I was very creative, too. I bought a banjo. Only because it had a case. And I could take this banjo off the ship, empty, and bring it back full of liquor. Which worked pretty well. And the interesting thing was, you could get away with drinking like that because, you know, like I was in one squadron, we had 10 guys shot down. And people would say, no wonder you drink so much. You know, but I would say, yeah. You know, I come back from some missions and, you know, people be, there'd be, you'd lose people. There'd be people getting refueled to come in. There'd be people in the ejection pattern because their plane was shot up so bad that if they brought them aboard ship, they'd follow the deck, as they say, and nobody else would be able to land. So they'd say, you stay here, and if we have time, after everybody lands, you can come in. Otherwise, you're going to have to eject. So, but everybody wasn't an alcoholic. There were a few, you know, in retrospect, there were a few, but I was an alcoholic and I got away with it. You come back from some of these missions and the flight surgeon would have given you these little bottles of liquor. Give me two. I have to go out again this afternoon. I need another one. Well, anyway, I did that and I wound up, how am I doing here? All right. I wound up having four combat tours in Vietnam. Which is probably too many, and that's hundreds of missions, shot at a lot, shot at and hit, had wingmen on fire, losing friends, all this other stuff, and you get to the point where it really didn't bother you at all. I mean, it really didn't bother you at all. You had two. Emotions, neutral and angry. And that was it. Don't bother me. Don't, you know, I don't care about it. Or you get upset. So, I was a real alcoholic doing that stuff. And, finally when that was over, and during this time I'd been married. I had a couple of kids. And after my fourth tour in Vietnam, I was sent to, as a flight instructor to, a base in Texas. I was a jet, flight instructor. And, because of my drinking, I said, you know, I'm gonna try and not drink for a while here to see what happens. Because drinking was really getting me in trouble. So I'm going to try and not drink. And I did it. I did it for a couple of months. I get to this new place. I did it for a couple of months. And I'm at a party. And I'm with my wife. And I'm the last one there because the guy's a friend of mine. And he said, and I hadn't been drinking for a couple of months. He says, you know, I got two beers in the refrigerator. Would you like one? And I said, sure, I'll have one. And that took me, that was my last run. Because I woke up, on the way home, I'm looking for a liquor store. And of course, I was living in a dry county in Texas, and there wasn't one. And then the next morning, I wake up, and the first thing I do is I go out, and I get booze, and I'm on my last run. And I wanted to stop drinking, let me rephrase that. I did not want to stop drinking. I wanted to find out how I could drink and not get in trouble. That's what I wanted to do. I would do it scientifically, you know. Don't smoke before you drink. Drink milk before you drink. Drink till after 6 o'clock. All the things they talk about in the book. I hadn't read the book. I could have written that part. I mean, I did it scientifically. And nothing worked. I got to the point where I was saying the wrong things to the wrong people. I wasn't showing up for work. Your commanding officer calls you and say, "What are you? You got to come in." And I said, "I'm not coming in. I'm too hungover." You know, they really didn't appreciate that. So. I called up AA. Now, I knew what an alcoholic was because I thought an alcoholic was a wino. So I called up AA, and I expect to meet this wino, and I don't know what he's going to tell me, but I want to know how I can drink and not get in trouble. The guy, turned out, wasn't a wino. The guy was a retired oil man who raised his horses for a hobby. So all of a sudden, I'm a little perplexed here. This doesn't meet my eye. And he tells me, he said, you're not a criminal and you're not a bad guy. You're simply sick with a disease of alcoholism. I said, what do you mean? He said, you are sick with the disease of alcoholism. And can you not drink until next Thursday? Because that's when they had the meeting in this town, one meeting a week on Thursday night. And when he told me, you know, I got to think about that, and that was probably the best news I ever had in my life. Because I could look back at my life, and I could see that every time that I really got jammed up, it was because I was drunk or drinking. And I didn't get in trouble every time I drank, but every time I got in trouble, I've been drinking. So it made a lot of sense to me. Like, I'm sick with the disease of alcoholism. And armed with that information, maybe I can do better, you know? And I started doing better. But I changed my addictions. Now that I'm not drinking, I switched over to having girlfriends. That's the way it was. And now I'm sober a couple of months, and now the Navy says, you know, looking back at all of the trouble you caused, we don't think we want your services anymore. So the Navy politely asked me to leave. So here I am, sober a couple of months, and I was a flight instructor. And so I actually wound up going to college. I hadn't been to college, so I went to college and did wind up getting a degree and graduating with honors from college, and got myself a job. And then the Navy decided at this time that they needed my services. So I was recalled into the Navy. They needed flight instructors, so they recalled me back into the Navy. And I went back into the Navy, and stayed until I actually retired from the Navy. And I started out as a recruit, and when I left, I was a commanding officer. Interestingly enough, there was when you in the Navy and you're a naval officer and you want to get promoted, your service record has to be very current and up to date. There can't be any gaps or spaces or anything like that. So there is a process where you can hire someone, give them a power of attorney, and they can go to your service record and make sure that it's complete. So I hired a person to do that for me. And the guy came back with an interesting comment. He said, I went through your record. He said, it's complete. He said, but it's very confusing to me. He said, because it's like two different people with the same Social Security number. And one of them was when I was drinking, and the other was when I was not drinking. Now, he didn't know this. I mean, he may have surmised it, but he had no information. I wasn't going to tell the guy, by the way, I'm an alcoholic. So that was interesting. And I've had other interesting things happen. I was in the aggressor squadron here at Miramar, and I'm sure you've heard of Top Gun. Well, the Top Gun people have to fight somebody else. They can't be fighting each other all the time, and that's what they have, the aggressor squadron. And I was in that squadron out at Miramar, and of course it was there were a lot of command performances you had to go through, which means if there was a squadron party, you had to go to that squadron party. So so I would go and have a club soda with a piece of lemon in it or something, you know, and you know, Friday night happy hour, and say hello to the people that I had to see me, that had to see me, and I would leave. And interestingly enough, one of the guys crashed his Corvette into a something, and they told him, you know, you better go see Griff. And he said, why do I want to see Griff? He's drunk at the club every Friday night. Just because he saw me there, he assumed I was drinking. So, and he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous now. So what happened with me was Alcoholics Anonymous turned out to be the absolute best thing that happened to me. Now, I'd like to tell you that I came in, I read the literature, I did the steps, and I became a saint. but that wasn't the way it worked. I wound up interestingly to me, one time I was asked to list my positive assets and my negative assets, and I said one of my positive assets was that I meet people easily, and he said, yeah, but you're married and you've got two kids. Which, you know, all of a sudden made sense to me. Yeah, so I thought, well, if nobody knows about what I'm doing, nobody's getting hurt by it. But, you know, I had to change my behavior. I didn't do the steps right away. I decided that self-knowledge was gonna save me. I read the books, you know. I'd go to the meetings. I didn't need to do any steps. Besides, I got some stuff in my past that I really am not interested in sharing with anybody. And plus, I'm a very secretive person. Along with that, so I don't really need to do any steps. And I had maybe too many girlfriends, and so I wind up, where does that get me? That gets me actually on the living room floor in the fetal position, rocking back and forth, saying, why do I feel so terrible? I'm not drinking. Why do I feel so terrible? And it drove me into doing the steps. Alcohol drove me into Alcoholics Anonymous, and not doing the steps drove me into doing the steps. And doing the steps really made made the biggest difference for me. It changed my life. I said I wasn't a moral person, and I wasn't a person of conscience, and things really didn't bother me. All the time I was over in Vietnam, none of that really bothered me at all. I needed to have a moral code, and Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the steps to follow. I know it. People say that there isn't a time restriction or set up for the steps. But in my opinion, and people that I work with, I recommend that you start the steps right away, because it's like carrying around a loaded bomb. You never know when it's going to go off. If I'm not doing the steps, if I'm not on a program of recovery, I'm just a guy that's not, or I'm just a person that's not drinking. So with step one, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, and my life become unmanageable. Boy, I had proven to myself over and over again that I was powerless over alcohol. You know, I had told myself I was not going to drink so much. You know, I wasn't going to get drunk again. And I was going to drink, but I wasn't going to get drunk again. And, you know, I mean, I know when I'm lying because I'm a very good liar. But I would tell my wife, honey, I'm going to go to happy hour and I'm coming home at 6 o'clock. And I was not lying. That was what I thought was the truth. And I would, sometimes I wouldn't come home. Sometimes I'd crash the car. Sometimes I would crash the car with a woman, not my wife, in it. You know, all kinds of compromising things. And my life is still unmanageable. That's one thing that I've come to accept, that my life is still unmanageable. For instance, several of you people did not know that I was going to be the guy showing up here tonight. You know, things happen in life that I don't plan. I was a jet pilot, and we would plan things right down to the second, right down to the last little pound of fuel, and nothing ever went the way you planned it. You're always adjusting. You're always adjusting. The winds might be different. The temperature might be different. The target might not be there. You might show up at a target that's already been destroyed, so you have to change targets. You might get a red light, and the guy in front of you might stall his car. So my life is still today unmanageable, and like two things I want to do today is not take a drink and not have to apologize for my behavior when my life becomes unmanageable. And on the second step, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. This is my own idea. I believe there's two kinds of insanity. I mean, I think there's alcoholic insanity, and I think there's downright mental illness. Some people think if you're an alcoholic, you're automatically mentally ill. I'm not qualified to say whether you are or not. But I think there are people who are mentally ill, who are perfectly good members of Alcoholics, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I can find a way to not drink, if I can change just enough not to not drink, then alcoholic insanity will leave me. You know, I mean, I'm not drinking right now, so I don't have that alcoholic insanity at this particular time. And made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understand Him. That was very difficult for me at first because I'm not a God person. I'm not a religious person. Even when I was in parochial school, I didn't really want to be a part of any of that. But I learned the word today. You know, I turned my will and life over to the care of God as I understand Him today. You know. And when I talk to people and they say, well, I don't understand God today. Okay, that's good. That's what you turn it over to. Go to the next step. It doesn't say I have to understand a power greater than myself perfectly. It says as I understand it. And another thing is, let's just say a power greater than ourselves was here today. What do you want me to do? Well, you're an alcoholic, aren't you? Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Well, this is what I want you to do. I don't want you to drink today. You're a liar, cheat, and a thief. I want you to try not to lie, cheat, or steal. Don't hurt yourself or don't hurt anybody else. That's what I want you to do today. Can you understand that? Yes, I can understand it. I can try and do that. I can try and do that. And that's, you know, pretty much that's what my power greater than myself wants me to do, you know. Don't hurt myself. Don't hurt anybody else. Try not to lie, cheat, or steal. And don't take a drink no matter what. You know, and then the promises will start coming true for me. And a lot of them have. I wound up getting a divorce from my first wife, for obvious reasons. But I was afraid to get married again because I was such an unfaithful husband. I wasn't a good husband, and I'm married today because I made a commitment, but I made the commitment to myself. I made a commitment to myself that I was going to be a good husband. I made a commitment to myself that I was going to be a faithful husband. I went to a friend of mine used to, he's gone now. His name was Milt Giverson. And he said he made a decision that he was going to stop saying those nasty little cutting remarks to his wife. And I took that to heart. And I stopped that. You know, a lot of times I just have to keep my mouth shut. But I stopped that. And the promises come true. It says that our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. How much does it have to change? It doesn't say how much it has to change. It says some of us are sicker than others. So some of our lives have to change more than others. I'll give you the analogy of Las Vegas. If you go to Las Vegas and you win 51% of the time, you're a winner. If you go to Las Vegas and you win 49% of the time, you are a loser. The difference is 2%. So how many percentage points do I need as an alcoholic to be successful in this program? You know, I think for me, you know, just waking up, going, if I go through the program of recovery, or I go through the steps, if I have a sponsor, if I do my service work, I mean, I think that's putting me way up by 80%. I mean, I think that's pretty good. I mean, if I went to Las Vegas, I won 80% of the time, you know, we'd all be having dinner on me tonight. And the last thing I'll say is, and if I could say this for new people, I've seen this happen. One of the promises is that we'll know serenity and no peace. We'll have serenity and no peace. And what I've seen a lot of times with some newcomers is, if you get into the program and you read the material, and things start going okay for you. You know what I mean? And all of a sudden, you get that sense that something's not right. Something's wrong, and you don't know what it is. Something is wrong with my life, and I don't know what it is. And it may be that. Comprehend the word serenity and know peace, because most of us are so comfortable with chaos that when we get this peace, it makes us a little bit uncomfortable. So if you're new and you're feeling uncomfortable, I'd recommend just taking a deep breath and go to the next step. Thank you very much.